Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 4th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: Trump said he plans to roll back federal fuel economy rules for passenger vehicles, his latest move to relieve the U.S. auto industry from mandates to build cleaner, more fuel-efficient cars. Vanguard plans to start letting workers buy an annuity within a 401k target date fund that it will make available to employers in 2026. Major U.S. stock indexes advanced with the S&P 500, Dow Industrials, and NASDAQ, gaining 0.3%, 0.9%, and 0.2% respectively. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman has explored putting together funds to acquire or partner with a rocket company, which would allow him to compete against Musk's SpaceX. An industry group said it aims to organize Amazon's delivery service providers to fight for better terms and reverse policies they say wipe out their profits. More than 57 million people watched the Dallas Cowboys beat the Kansas City Chiefs on CBS on Thanksgiving, setting a viewing record for a regular season NFL game. HSBC named Brendan Nelson as chairman following a year-long search to fill one of the biggest jobs in global finance. The FTC directed Boeing to divest itself of Spirit AeroSystems assets to resolve antitrust concerns about its proposed acquisition of the parts maker. Dollar Tree logged higher profit and sales for the quarter ended November 1st and raised its full-year profit outlook as U.S. consumers remain willing to spend. Macy's raised its full-year outlook and reported its highest comparable sales growth in 13 quarters as its turnaround plan begins to deliver results. Now the key articles from the Worldwide section. Two survivors of a September 2nd U.S. strike on a drug boat in the Caribbean were killed in follow-on attacks after they were seen still aboard the damaged vessel alongside packages of illegal narcotics. A senior commander was expected to tell lawmakers. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth asked Admiral Alvin Halsey, then the head of U.S. military operations in the Caribbean, to step down before announcing the officer's retirement in mid-October. A Pentagon watchdog found that Hegseth violated some department regulations when he shared sensitive information from his cell phone on Signal earlier this year. Federal agents arrived in New Orleans, the latest focus of the Trump administration's strengthened immigration enforcement. The EU scaled back a plan to use Russia's frozen assets to make a loan to Ukraine, leaving a window open for a U.S. push to use the money to lure Russia into a peace deal. The bloc reached a deal to permanently halt imports of Russian gas, a milestone in the EU's efforts to sever energy ties with Moscow. Former FDA commissioner said new vaccine standards threaten to put Americans' health at risk and upend the agency's scientific integrity. Republican Representative Elise Stefanik, a prominent Trump ally, criticized House Speaker Mike Johnson, calling him an ineffective leader who is losing control of the GOP conference heading into the midterm elections. Trump will pardon Texas Democratic Representative Henry Cuellar and his wife, who were charged last year with allegedly taking nearly $600,000 in foreign bribes. An audit by Israel's Public Defender's Office found conditions for Palestinian security prisoners deteriorated severely after the October 7th attacks. A widely cited study on economic damage from climate change was retracted following criticism from peers. The picture on today's front page shows a huge intersection where cars are stopped after coming out of what appears to be a tunnel, and many people are crossing the street along with those on bikes or motorcycles. And that caption reads, "People in Venezuela's capital, Caracas, are maintaining a sense of normalcy despite punishing inflation and tensions with the U.S. The article, "On Caracas Streets, Inflation Dreaded Most. Rising prices stress Christmas shoppers more than an American warships off coast," by Kedgel V.S. Caracas, Venezuela. With a U.S. Navy flotilla off the coast and President Trump pushing for strongman Nicolas Maduro's ouster, Venezuelans are focused on a more urgent matter, the price of Christmas preparations. Shoppers are filling malls, but finding they are blowing their entire paycheck on gifts and decorations. Supermarkets are flush with the pork leg and ham-stuffed breads that are staples of the holiday feast and are almost twice as expensive as last year. And in one posh neighborhood, illuminated by massive LED screens, imported Christmas trees from Canada are going for the equivalent of $300, more than what most people earn monthly. Here in this capital city of 3 million people, the drumbeat of war feels distant and unreal. Residents say they have seen attempts before to dethrone Maduro and aren't holding their breath this time. Instead, their main concern is chronic inflation that this year is expected to hit 270%. And then surge to 682% by the end of 2026, according to the International Monetary Fund. Trump to roll back rules on fuel economy. Move will lower the requirement for passenger cars and kill credits system. By Sharon Turlip and Scott Patterson. President Trump on Wednesday said he plans to roll back federal fuel economy rules for passenger vehicles, his latest move to relieve the U.S. auto industry from mandates to build cleaner, more fuel-efficient cars. The administration's move comes months after Congress and the Trump administration this summer essentially nullified the mandates, known as Corporate Average Fuel Economy Rules, or CAFE, by eliminating fines for violating them. Under the changes, the federal government would require an average of 34.5 miles a gallon for vehicles by model year 2031, down from the 50.4 miles a gallon standard set by the Biden administration. It also does away with a system in which automakers can buy credits from competitors to offset fines, a step up that proved to be a boon for electric vehicle maker Tesla. Lowering the standards would enshrine into federal law more lenient miles per gallon targets for automakers. It could make it harder to require to tougher standards, since doing so would require more than simply reinstating penalties. We're protecting our auto workers, and we're making it easier for every family to afford high-quality cars, Trump said from the Oval Office. In other words, we're bringing automobiles back and the manufacturing of automobiles back into this country. The proposal must undergo an official rulemaking process before being adopted. The changes would apply to all model year passenger cars and light trucks from 2022 to 2031. Mexican drug lords choose snitch or suffer. More than 55 cartel leaders were turned over to the U.S. by their home country in cloak and dagger missions. By Stephen Fisher and Santiago Perez, Mexico City. Dozens of Mexico's most dangerous prisoners, cuffed hand and foot, boarded army jets under heavy guard this year, a rogues gallery of cartel leaders responsible for smuggling tons of heroin, fentanyl, cocaine, and methamphetamine to insatiable U.S. buyers. The men were rousted from prisons where money and corruption provided them with weapons, cocaine, booze, women, and phones to run their lucrative and underworld empires from behind bars, coordinating drug shipments as well as ordering killings and kidnappings, U.S. and Mexican officials said. The prisoners had no idea of their destination. Welcome to America, said Derek Malls, interim head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, when he greeted the first batch of prisoners as they disembarked 9 months ago. A second group arrived in August, a total of 55 men who faced charges that could keep them locked in maximum security prisons for the rest of their lives. The prisoners represent the top echelons of Mexico's biggest criminal organizations, the Sinaloa, Jalisco New Generation, and Zetas cartels. They include Rafael Caro Quintero, who is charged with killing DEA agent Enrique Kiki Camarena in 1985 and has dodged extradition to the U.S. for decades. All are in custody without bail. U.S. officials expect many of the prisoners will share firsthand knowledge about the operations of Mexico's underworld, from smuggling secrets and money laundering operations to the names of officials in government, the military, law enforcement, and finance who are paid to serve the drug traffickers. Cartel leaders in U.S. custody have for years had the opportunity to cooperate with authorities, sometimes in exchange for reduced sentences and more comfortable prison conditions. Former Sinaloa cartel leader Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who has kept mum, spends 23 hours a day in a windowless U.S. prison cell serving a life sentence. One of his sons, Joaquin Guzman Lopez, turned himself in to U.S. authorities last year and dragged along another wanted man, his godfather, Ismael El Mayo Zambada, the 70-something co-founder of the Sinaloa cartel. Zambada, whose lawyer said he was illegally brought to the U.S., has pleaded guilty to drug charges. His sentencing hearing is January 13th. The younger Guzman pleaded guilty Monday to drug trafficking and money laundering charges. He is cooperating with U.S. authorities, prosecutors said at the court hearing. Transferring 55 drug leaders to U.S. custody was a high-stakes undercover mission that drew 2,000 Mexican special forces. Officials feared that if word got out, kingpins would attempt escapes, set off riots, or file legal appeals. Authorities also believe cartels might try to assassinate their own leaders rather than risk them spilling secrets to U.S. law enforcement. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Vanguard joins push for 401k annuities by Ann Turgeson. Vanguard Group plans to start letting workers buy an annuity within a new 401k target date fund. The nation's largest target date fund provider will make the fund available to employers starting sometime in 2026. Like any target date fund, it will combine stocks and bonds, shifting to a more conservative mix as investors age. But it will also give older workers the option of moving some of their 401k savings into an annuity, an insurance contract that converts an upfront lump sum payment into fixed monthly payments for life. A 65-year-old worker nearing retirement with a $1 million portfolio might use 25% to pay for an annuity, which today could provide about $1,670 a month. The worker would also be able to withdraw from the rest of the 401k savings, which would remain in stocks and bonds. The move by Vanguard, which manages about 40% of the $4.5 trillion in target date funds, suggests that annuities embedded in diversified 401k investments are slowly moving into the mainstream. Target date funds are typically the default investments when employers automatically enroll workers in 401k plans. Until recently, employers have largely focused on helping workers accumulate larger 401k balances. But as baby boomers retire, they are adding products and services that aim to replicate pensions, which cover a dwindling share of the U.S. workforce. As 401ks have surpassed pensions, there is far less guaranteed income in retirement, said Lauren Valenti, head of the Workplace Solutions at Vanguard. Annuities provide a stream of income that is insulated from stock market losses and can eliminate the risk of running out of money, she said. Vanguard's rivals, including State Street Investment Management, J.P. Morgan Asset Management, and BlackRock, have also introduced target date funds with annuities. Around 4% of 401k plans now offer such a fund, an option that wasn't widely available until the past couple of years, according to Kalin, an investment consulting firm. Waymos are done being nice. Self-driving cars learn to bend rules of the road. By Catherine Bindley. San Francisco. It was like a scene out of a movie. A pair of white Jaguars zipping through a two-lane tunnel, changing lanes at the same time in a zigzag formation. But this one had a twist. They were both Waymos, the self-driving vehicles known for their achingly cautious behavior. I had never seen anyone switch lanes in that tunnel, said Sophia Yen, a startup founder who was in her car behind the two autonomous ones in September. It's driving more like a taxi driver, an aggressive New York taxi driver. For years, while training on the streets of San Francisco and eventually transporting passengers, Waymos were the most polite drivers on the road. Pull up to a stop sign at the same time as a Waymo, and it would wait, as if to say, "No, please, after you." If you were trying to go around another car making a left, a Waymo was sure to let you in. The training wheels are off, like the rule-following nice guy who's tired of being taken advantage of. Waymos are putting their own needs first. They're bending traffic laws, getting impatient with pedestrians, and embracing the idea that when it comes to city driving, politeness doesn't pay. Admiral to contend, survivors of boat strike were fair target. Commander to tell Congress that damaged craft tried to continue drug run. By Shelby Holliday and Alexander Ward. Washington. Two survivors of a September 2nd U.S. strike on a boat in the Caribbean were killed in follow-up attacks after they were seen still aboard the damaged vessel alongside packages of illegal narcotics. A senior commander is expected to tell lawmakers Thursday. Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley plans to say he and his legal advisor concluded the two survivors were attempting to continue their drug run, making them and the already damaged vessel legitimate targets for another attack, two defense officials said. The details of the strike have emerged as a key matter of concern for members of Congress who are seeking more information about the role played by Bradley and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and whether aspects of the operation violated laws of war or Pentagon procedures. The version of events Bradley is expected to deliver will rebut claims by legal experts that the killing of the two survivors could have constituted a war crime. Lawmakers are likely to press Bradley, who commanded Joint Special Operations Command at the time, in the closed-door briefing on the extent of the damage to the boat, whether the men were injured, how Bradley reached his conclusions that the survivors were still legitimate targets, and whether he considered rescuing them. The attack was the first use of military force against drug boats by the administration and the only one in which survivors are known to have been targeted and killed in follow-up strikes. EU will ban Russian gas. By Julia Petroni. The European Union reached a deal to permanently halt imports of Russian gas, a significant milestone in the bloc's efforts to sever energy ties with Moscow following the invasion of Ukraine. Under the agreement, all imports of Russian gas would be banned from the fall of 2027, with earlier phase-out deadlines for liquefied natural gas and short-term supply contracts. This historic decision will end the EU's dependence on an unreliable supplier, which has repeatedly destabilized European energy markets, put at risk security of supply with energy blackmail, and harmed the European economy, the European Commission said on Wednesday. Russian LNG imports will be phased out by December 31, 2026, and pipeline gas by September 30, 2027. However, individual member states might extend this deadline to October 31, 2027, if their gas storage levels fall below required thresholds. The Commission said it also remains committed to phasing out all remaining oil imports from Russia by the end of 2027. "We're turning that page, and we're turning it for good," said European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. "This is the dawn of a new era, the era of full energy independence from Russia." Russian gas currently accounts for 13% of EU imports, down from roughly 45% before Moscow's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Oil imports also have declined to 2% from 26% in early 2022, according to the EU. The bloc now sources most of its gas from Norway and other suppliers, including the U.S. Europe scales back Ukraine loan plan. Proposal addresses Belgium's concerns, lets U.S. use funds as a lure for Moscow. By Lawrence Norman and Matthew Luxmore. The European Union has scaled back a plan to use Russia's frozen assets to make a massive loan to Ukraine, seeking to address Belgian concerns and leaving a window open for Washington's push to employ the money to lure Russia into a deal. The EU is now proposing to lend Ukraine about $105 billion over the next 2 years, down from a previous plan to loan as much as $186 billion. The reduction would leave reserves that the Trump administration has proposed using as part of a potential agreement. European officials say the reduction will help ease the concerns of Belgium, where most of the funds are held. The country has said it could face significant financial exposure if there were a successful legal challenge to the use of the assets. Privately, some officials say the new plan also gives Europe leverage in a peace process that has largely sidelined them, with American officials negotiating directly with Russia and Ukraine. The money can't be returned to Russia without the EU's agreement to lift sanctions on the funds. "With today's proposals, we will ensure Ukraine has the means to defend themselves and take forward peace negotiations from a position of strength," European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said Wednesday. The Trump administration has intensified its efforts to end the conflict, shuffling between meetings with Ukrainian and Russian officials. A five-hour meeting with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin on Tuesday didn't yield a breakthrough. The EU holds about $245 billion in Russian central bank assets under sanctions that were enacted days after Russia's 2022 invasion. Roughly $55 billion in assets are held under sanctions in the U.S. and elsewhere. For Ukraine, access to the assets would provide a lifeline as its economy is struggling to stay afloat. Kyiv is squeezed between financing its defensive effort and the repair of infrastructure. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has long advocated for Russian reparations to Ukraine and has said using Russian assets would lessen the burden on his country and make Moscow pay for its aggression. Under the initial plan, the EU essentially was going to loan money against the frozen assets to Ukraine with the idea that Russia eventually would pay reparations for its invasion. Kyiv wouldn't have to repay the money until Moscow did so. The assets were singled out in a Trump administration plan. Under the plan, which was drafted with Russian input, $100 billion of the assets would be used for a U.S.-led investment plan to help Ukraine recover from the war. The rest of the money was earmarked for U.S.-Russian economic projects. European officials balked at that idea. They insist that the assets should be used to help Ukraine, a position that was agreed upon among all the Group of Seven nations during the Biden administration. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said Washington would discuss the asset issue with European partners. European capitals have chafed at being left on the sidelines in the U.S. talks with Russia and Ukraine. Diplomats have pointed to the assets as leverage to ensure European interests are heeded in talks and that any plan has the backing of Europe and Kyiv. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, Putin says nye again to Trump. Another schlep to Moscow by President Trump's envoys has produced another Vladimir Putin rejection of another plan to end his war with Ukraine. Maybe it's time to conclude that Mr. Putin doesn't want peace. He wants Ukraine. Kremlin officials called 5 hours of talks with Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner constructive, but also said the root causes of the war still haven't been addressed. By root causes, the Kremlin means that Ukraine is still free of Russian control. For months, Mr. Putin has refused Mr. Trump's proposals for even a temporary ceasefire along the current battle lines, which Ukraine accepted. The administration put Ukraine over a barrel with its 28-point draft peace plan, and Kyiv is trying to discern the worst deal it can tolerate and still survive as a free country. Where are Mr. Putin's concessions? The Russian wants to swallow the entire Donbass in Ukraine's east and deny Ukraine the military and the security allies to protect itself in the future. Mr. Putin wants to look like he's negotiating, and the Witkoff meetings help him maintain that veneer, while he tries to drive a wedge between Mr. Trump and Europe. Moscow is also working hard to persuade the world it's winning the war. The Donbass will soon be theirs anyway, the Kremlin says. Yet Ukraine's defeat isn't inevitable or imminent. When I'm with Ukraine's Corps Commander units and I'm watching them in action, retired U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery said on a call this week, I don't believe they'll lose this on the ground on their own. But the U.S. isn't keeping up its weapons support, and selling arms to Europe isn't making up the difference. Mr. Putin won't negotiate seriously as long as he thinks he has the upper hand, and our hope has been that the White House would eventually figure this out. No such luck so far. A pivot would mean snatching Mr. Putin's frozen assets, ramping up sanctions to include China, and delivering long-range missiles and other weapons to Ukraine. But the Trump administration is stuck in a view of Mr. Putin's motives that is contradicted by events, that commerce and cultural exchange among Ukraine, Russia, and the U.S. will be insurance against war. That misplaced optimism is familiar from liberal internationalists who think the world is prospering toward peace and whom Mr. Trump derides as globalist. What negotiations need is an injection of Mr. Trump's instinct for American primacy in the world and realism about the man in the Kremlin. From the opinion pages, U.S. San Diego and the crisis of education. When 1 in 12 freshmen can't do middle school math, that suggests America is in trouble. By Ben Sasse. The number of freshmen entering the University of California, San Diego, whose math skills fall below a high school level, has increased nearly 30-fold over the past 5 years, according to a shocking new report from the university's Senate Administration Working Group on Admissions. Worse still, 1 in 12 entering freshmen have math skills below middle school levels. That means college students might struggle with questions such as this: 7 plus 2 equals 6 plus. Or this: Sarah had 9 pennies and 9 dimes. How many coins did she have in all? Before exploring what went wrong, let's begin by crediting the UCSD workgroup, made up of faculty members and administrators, for telling the truth. Sure, that's a low bar, but it's one that many other universities have lacked the courage to clear. The remedial math instructors and their faculty colleagues who stood beside them also deserve credit for sounding the alarm. This mass failure is the result of 3 intersecting crises. The first, and furthest downstream, crisis is that a highly selective college could admit so many young adults who are so tragically unprepared. The fix to this problem is twofold. First, university leaders must acknowledge that the test optional admissions experiment has been an abject failure. They need to reverse course, ignore the screaming of DEI dead-enders, and reinstate the SAT, ACT, or CLT, the new classic learning test, required to enable sufficient quality control in admissions and ensure college classes can be taught at a college level. Second, for already admitted students, further assessment should be required to ensure that those who need remedial courses, which shouldn't involve college credit, receive them. It's critical that UCSD, long considered a public ivy, restore its brand credibility with parents, policymakers, employers, and future applicants. The college must ensure that a degree in 2026, 2027, and 2028 pledges that graduates carrying UCSD parchment actually completed a college education. That likely will require a math exit exam. Such institution-wide assessment and response will also demand fundamental curricular reform, guided by sober-minded leaders moving at speeds unknown among academic bureaucratic committees. The other two root crises are scarier. The UCSD revelation likely means the U.S. has millions of recent high school graduates and 20-somethings who are unprepared to navigate modern work and life and lack the logical problem-solving skills with which algebra has traditionally armed adolescents. But it gets worse. The students admitted to UCSD were, on average, receiving A grades in high school math classes that supposedly built multiple years beyond algebraic and arithmetic foundations. This was a fraud. High schools have clearly made inflating grades beyond what many students earned or deserved. How could schools do such a disservice to taxpayers and, more important, to these students? Part of the blame can be assigned to pandemic learning loss, but who decided to pretend that students not remotely competent in the subject matter should be lied to and about, that they had achieved mastery levels? Had this happened in a state that emphasizes accountability, the governor would lead an urgent investigation into how we got here. But California Governor Gavin Newsom is testing the waters on a 2028 presidential campaign, and it seems improbable that he will raise questions the left-wing teachers' unions, his would-be companion allies, want left unasked. After all, the San Francisco Unified School District has been intentionally teaching less rigorous math since 2014 on the ridiculous claim that math is racist, with nary a peep of protest from Mr. Newsom until 82% of voters expressed disapproval for these anti-rigor policies at the ballot box last year. Given this vacuum of good leadership, Congress should hold hearings examining how these students were systematically failed and how federal tax dollars continued to pour into a system this fundamentally corrupt. A serious public should be paying attention to a crisis of this scale. It merits a full congressional investigation and bipartisan outrage. Instead, the conversation is likely to be hijacked by something more tribal and less productive, a partisan brawl over the bureaucratic fate of the Education Department. President Trump's renewed proposal to abolish the department will likely dominate headlines, consuming oxygen that should be focused on immediate accountability and real reform. For the record, I support eliminating the department. It's wasteful and largely ineffective. But there's a constitutional process for doing so, and that runs through Congress, the branch of government that writes the laws. What we'll get instead of deliberation and reform is another spectacle like a dozen others currently raging in Washington, captivating only those addicted to political combat, while real victims are ignored yet again. A more helpful place for policy focus is the broken educational pipeline that led to the college in La Jolla now needing to teach fourth grade fractions. We don't yet know how California-centric this problem is, but we need to find out. The National Assessment of Educational Progress suggested last year that our children's math proficiency has dropped so much since 2013 that we've eroded away almost four decades of prior national progress. The Cold War's Sputnik, 1957, and A Nation at Risk, 1983, educational crisis moments were big alarm bells. But the UCSD canary in the coal mine might be bigger. It isn't enough to be enraged about this national abdication. We need to build a plan to fix it. That starts with an honest examination of how low our starting point is. Mr. Sasse, a former university president, served as a U.S. Senator from Nebraska 2015 to 23. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Tariffs can make work pay again. A payroll tax cut would mean instant raises and a more productive economy. By Arthur Laffer and Stephen Moore. There's good and bad in President Trump's suggestion to send a $2,000 check of tariff revenues to each U.S. family. Though incomes have been rising faster than overall consumer prices this year, Americans are still understandably angry about the rising cost of health care, housing, and tuition. Giving back tariff revenue to help families' finances is a good idea. But if the White House doesn't tie that money to work, it will repeat a painful Biden administration mistake. Stimulating supply, not demand, brings down prices and raises worker pay. The key to affordability is a stable, strong dollar and rewards for increased work and production. The dollar end of that equation is the Federal Reserve's job, but the White House can use tariff revenues to goose the other side. Cutting the 15.3% federal payroll tax for 12 to 18 months by up to 5 points, evenly divided between employer and employee, would provide every low and middle income American worker an immediate pay raise while lowering labor costs and prices. Tariff revenue could cover the cost. The vital difference between a tariff tax cut and a tariff rebate check is that the former increases supply. Lower payroll taxes encourage work. Because the payroll tax is paid on the first dollar of income a worker earns, a cut helps everyone, including the people most hurt by higher prices, low and middle income workers living from paycheck to paycheck. And it has the added Made in America effect of reducing input cost for U.S. exports and alternatives to foreign imports. Mailing checks does the opposite of all this. As the country painfully experienced through the Biden administration's inflationary spending, particularly its continuance of COVID subsidy checks, throwing cash at the demand side of the economy raises prices. Mr. Trump expressed interest when we advised him to enact this payroll cut. He could potentially do this by issuing an executive order suspending the withholding of these payroll taxes for 12 to 18 months. The president understands that the first and most important effect would be that Americans earn more income as they are increasing national production, spurred too by the lower cost to companies of hiring and paying workers. Americans will be richer, gross domestic product will rise, and goods will cost less. The static budgetary cost of a 5-point payroll tax reduction would be approximately $600 billion for a 12-month period and $900 billion for 18 months. The dynamic cost would be much lower due to the resulting significant increase in work, take-home pay, and production, which would increase the tax base for all levels of government. The cut wouldn't impair Social Security or Medicare finances. The government would credit tariff revenues dollar for dollar to these retirement funds for the lost payroll tax money. The president wants his tariffs to get Americans working good-paying jobs. Using the revenue to cut taxes is the best way to do it. Our digestible immigrants, what the Somali welfare scam tells us about America's other migration problems. By Barton Swaim. If you wanted to invent a parable of modern liberalism's failure, you'd have to work hard to top the story of Somalis, immigrants, and U.S. citizens alike, bilking Minnesota's social welfare system. So enormous and brazen was the theft that the New York Times treated it with a competent and mostly unflinching article, which is the only reason anybody outside the small world of conservative punditry knows about it. The time it took for the Minnesota story to make its way into national headlines is itself part of the problem. Federal prosecutors have already convicted 59 of the fraudsters, which tells you how long the thing has been happening. A few local media outlets, notably KARE, Minneapolis-St. Paul's NBC affiliate, have covered the story since the first indictments. Scott W. Johnson, the Minnesota-based attorney and Powerline blog co-founder, has reported on Somali-related fraud since at least 2018. In mid-November, the journalist Armin Rosen penned a superb 7,000-word essay about the fiasco for the magazine County Highway. The Somali fraud story is in some respects akin to the so-called grooming scandal in Britain, in which gangs of mostly Pakistani men sexually abused young girls, even as the country's government and news media looked the other way, terrified by accusations of racism or Islamophobia. In the Twin Cities, state authorities couldn't rouse themselves to stop the theft. Hundreds of millions of dollars siphoned from Medicaid, housing, and other welfare programs. It is to the great credit of the U.S. Justice Department, under administrations of both parties, that it didn't allow the perpetrators' race, religion, or country of origin to hinder the prosecution of crime. Both scandals in the UK and Minnesota raise a question most of us would rather not consider, that of large-scale immigration from predominantly Muslim countries. It's true that other ethnic immigrant groups, Italians in the early 20th century most famously, imported forms of criminality from the home country. It's also true that Minnesota's roughly 80,000-strong Somali community contains many industrious people and good citizens. But an unbiased observer could be forgiven for thinking Minnesota's Somali population isn't capable of assimilation. From Mr. Rosen's essay, bad actors within the community would approach potential co-conspirators without any fear of betrayal. Even the people who said no to phenomenal offers of tens of thousands of dollars in free taxpayer money didn't inform the authorities that a major community-wide fraud against the public was in progress. Potentially criminal oddities went almost totally unreported to anyone in government. The FBI learned about Feeding Our Future, a nonprofit that was one of the main vehicles of fraud, from a whistleblower in the Department of Education, and not from any of the scam's ground-level witnesses or participants. Ponder some observations made recently by the British historian Tom Holland. His book, Dominion, 2019, contends that Christianity has left an imprint on the West so deep as to be ineradicable and imperceptible. Even atheists in nations once Christianized think in Christian terms without knowing it. Only a Christian nation, I suspect Mr. Holland would say, would invent a social welfare system as lavish and easily exploitable as Minnesota's. Essentially, what Christianity has that Islam does not is a concept of the secular. From its beginning, Mr. Holland points out, Christianity has acknowledged that some parts of human society will function outside the demands of revelation. Think of Jesus' imperative to render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. Islam classically acknowledges no such sphere. I think Islam is uniquely indigestible for a secular mindset, he says. Minnesota's Somali population plainly doesn't think of itself as digestible. But large-scale Muslim immigration is a far bigger problem for Europe than for America. On Tuesday, President Trump, asked about the Minnesota fraud prosecutions, expressed his disgust. These aren't people that work. These aren't people that say, let's go, come on, let's make this place great. These are people that do nothing but complain. They come from hell and they complain and do nothing but bitch. The president singled out for particular scorn Minneapolis's Representative Ilhan Omar. Put aside, if you can, Mr. Trump's failure to distinguish between criminals and law-abiding Americans of Somali ancestry. The president isn't wrong to sense something deeply amiss in a community of Americans so contemptuous of the country that took them in. Perhaps Mr. Trump can turn his attention to those illegal aliens from nations that, for all their dysfunctions, are indelibly Christian. Immigrants from Latin America work. Indeed, they have a higher labor force participation rate than whites. Reasonable people agree that criminals in the country illegally ought to be removed, but those working construction and agricultural jobs are saying in so many words, let's go, come on, let's make this place great. And they don't bitch. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 4th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.